Hello everyone and welcome back to another show, another week here at the Damage Report. The last week that I'm going to be in charge for a little bit. I'm going to be taking a bit of a staycation, but don't worry, the show will be in good hands. And those hands and the rest of the body attached to them, join us now. Francesca Fiorentini is here. How's it going, Francesca?
I have no body. It's just hands and this face. It's going great
for the show. But anyway, Francesca is going to be hosting the Damage Report next week for Monday through Thursday. I'll be returning on Friday, but you're going to be taking over. It's going to be a bit of TBR meets TDR. Are you excited?
Oh, yes, I'm excited to try not to swear for that long over a period of 4 days. You know, lest we be demonetized or something else bad happens. I don't know, the algorithm gets mad. I'm super excited, John. And yeah, you need a vacation, a staycation. And
I have a pretty easy life, but I appreciate that. Thank you.
We call it a timeout. Why don't we call it a timeout? Exactly. Dragon Daddy timeout.
Put me in the corner.
Yes.
But anyway, I'm excited to have more of your influence on the show. And obviously, you know, like you're going to be working with our team. We've got our format, blah, blah, blah. But that said, you know, you obviously have a different background. Feel free to bring to the show whatever you want. I'm sure that people will be very excited for that.
Sure. Lots of puppets. It'll happen.
Awesome. We've talked about that before. Anyway, that said, thank you everybody for being here. Through the course of the next hour, we've got a lot for you. We're going to be giving you updates on what's going on with Israel and Palestine. Spoiler alert, it's bad. AOC faces cancellation from a couple of the worst actors in politics. Matt Gaetz, bad updates for him. That's a shame. And Marjorie Greene might have broken the law. Weird, nobody could have seen that coming. And then we've got some absolute nonsense that'll be fun. So if we get through the important news, we'll get to that, of course. But thank you for being here, regardless of what platform you're on. You can of course hit the like button, share the stream, so the more people know that we're live. And as we go through this hour of news, feel free to send us tweets, comments, super chats, all that, and we'll respond as we can. Another little thing to look forward to, immediately following this show at twitch.tv/TYT, you can join Dr. Rashad Ritchie's Indisputable. Some are saying it's the best show on Twitch. Some are saying that's indisputable, but you will have to watch to find out for yourself immediately following today's episode of The Damage Report. And I believe, by the way, that Dr. Rashad Ritchie will be joining Francesca for some of her episodes hosting the show.
Yep.
That said, Francesca, are you ready to jump into this thing?
I think so.
I know. I know the weekends are so nice and then the news returns. So we must face it with a stiff upper lip. If you want to know how things are going with Israel and Palestine, well, pretty much how you expect and pretty much how we predicted. Loss of life has continued to escalate. The US has completely abdicated any sort of political or strategic or diplomatic or moral leadership. And there are some good people in US government speaking up for peace and for the civilians that are being slaughtered every single day. But they, of course, have very little political power. But let's catch up a bit on what's going on. Diplomatic efforts appeared stalled as the level of destruction was quickly escalating to the kind of violence that had not been seen since the last major conflict way back in 2014. That was a battle that ultimately claimed 2,200 lives, rendered large areas of the Gaza Strip uninhabitable. You know, very little had actually been repaired in terms of electrical and, you know, water infrastructure, of course. By the way, you know, so that was a quote from the New York Times, which, by the way, their coverage is fine on this topic. But they reference there a battle that ultimately claimed 2,200 lives. And I thought, wait a second, where's the breakdown on that, buddy? And so, yeah, no, more than 2,100 of those 2,200 were Palestinians, the vast majority civilians who'd been killed. On the Israeli side, there were 64 soldiers and 6 civilians who were killed. So that is a 70 to more than 2,100, which fits the historic pattern. And it reminded me, by the way, of a comment I saw from a professor, Rashid Khalidi, who was on Democracy Now! Over the last week, who said, one wonders what proportion you have of Arab deaths, of Palestinian deaths over Israeli deaths. Is it 20-1 before the US finally begins to recognize that this is not legitimate self-defense? This is a perfect illustration of the bias that has been a feature of American policy for many, many years. That is a perfectly valid sort of philosophical hypothetical. But apparently in past conflicts, no, that sort of ratio is not enough. Now, we're not there quite yet. In the past week, though, nearly 200 Palestinians have been killed in the most recent violence, more than 50 of whom were children. And Sunday, just yesterday, was the deadliest day, with at least 42 people killed, including at least 10 children, after an attack on a tunnel network caused 3 buildings to collapse. So, Francesca, that's the way that it's going right now. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's devastating, and it is sadly so common when it comes to the way that Israel fights and the way that Israel is hell-bent on its ultimate goal, you know, which is ethnic cleansing, which is, hey, Palestinians, just move or die. Or die very slowly. That's why we won't give you access to the COVID-19 vaccine. Perfect. See how this all works? And so this is, once again, we're calling for a ceasefire. I do think a ceasefire is important. But at the same time, we have to understand that there is no such thing as a status quo in Israel-Palestine. That status quo is continual displacement, is continual ethnic cleansing, is continually Palestinians living on smaller and smaller swaths of land, losing their homes, of becoming refugees in the world without the ability to return. That is the status quo. It is settlements from the Israeli side continuing to encroach into the West Bank. So remember, even in if and when, and man, I do hope there is a ceasefire soon. I do hope this is not a repeat of 2014. I hope that the world's outrage, which I do think is a little bit more unified this time around, we'll stop this sooner than getting to that 2000 number or more. But again, we just have to continue to remember, like, what is at the root of this? And the other thing is, you know, we're going to talk about it, but Israel's been targeting, they've been targeting journalists. They've been targeting emergency workers. They've been targeting civilians. This is how they do, right? This is par for the course. This isn't about a military versus another military, because Palestine doesn't have a military, right? Like, that's just what happens. And when you talk about Gaza, let's remember, this is the most populated place on earth. It is the most, that's why people call it an open air prison, right? Because it's surrounded by Israeli military, and there are people packed in there. So it is, you could argue that it would be a human rights crime or violation to even strike anywhere in Gaza, because the chances that you are going to kill civilians is incredibly high. That being said, Israel knows exactly where journalists and civilians and emergency workers live. And finally, last thing, I'm sorry to say, but it's been about 7 or 8 days now. Maybe I think today might be the 9th day of the siege on Gaza. You guys, people aren't getting in. There is no access for the outside world to get in and help Gaza. This is Gaza by itself. Yes, there are aid organizations. Yes, there can be money in. But in terms of, like, what would be the humanitarian thing, which is opening the inroads into Gaza, that is not possible right now. That is incredibly difficult. Humanitarian workers, journalists are not allowed in.
Yeah. Yeah. And in that way is largely a continuation of the status quo before blockade, you know, both economic and in terms of, you know, necessary medical aid, which was cruel and inhuman, a violation of fundamental human rights before the pandemic, let alone during it. And you systematically destroy the media's ability to accurately describe what's happening there. You're referencing there over the weekend, they destroyed the building housing Al Jazeera's bureau. That adds on to a long list of the AP and a number of other media outlets whose headquarters have all been, they just all happen to be near Hamas, I guess. And you know, a bunch of absolute troglodytes in right-wing media spent the weekend on social media applauding the destruction of these media headquarters. But yeah, I totally agree with what you said though about, like, even the road to a ceasefire, which we'll get to, are we calling for one? We'll talk about that. But what we are calling for potentially is a return to the status quo, but not a return to peace. That's the way it's presented by the mainstream media. But to believe that would require a great deal of ignorance about what the actual situation was. It wasn't peace, it wasn't justice. There was nothing humane about the lives that Gazans were forced to live before the most recent bombing campaigns. And the best case scenario right now, horrifically, is a return to that horror, which I guess is preferable to the widespread loss of civilian life that we're seeing on a daily basis now. And one of the one of the terrors of doing a show like this is just wondering, like, while we're doing this, we're not on social media, we're not tracking the news. And I don't know about you, Francesca, but I'm just always horrified. What's happening right now that I'm not seeing? What apartment complex is being destroyed? What, you know, a provider of medical devices in Gaza is being blown up? You know, what home in a refugee camp is being bombed? And that's happening right now.
Yeah, I mean, and then that's, yeah, the other thing is just to remember, like, refugee camps have been bombed. A man lost his entire family in a refugee camp. What more do you want from people? How much more are Gazans and Palestinians supposed to sacrifice? Like, what is acceptable? And I think you talked about this, you know, the ratio. So what if we get to 0 Israeli deaths and 100 Palestinians? Is that acceptable? My guess is no, because that's not part of the plan. The plan is no, Palestinians deserve it. No matter how many have to die, they deserve it because they are terrorists. End of story. That is exactly the narrative. And that is exactly the project of sort of militarized nation building that Israel sadly participates in, right? There is no good faith two-state solution that is done with. It is not even physically possible at this point, right? And so once again, like, remembering there is no line, there is no acceptable resistance. There is no, okay, well, if you just throw rocks, guys, remember what happens when children throw rocks in the West Bank? They are open fired upon. This last week, 13 Palestinians died in the West Bank, protesting, peaceful protests. I mean, throwing rocks. So again, this is, I mean, we don't need a stretch of the imagination in the United States here when you see peaceful demonstrators, you know, all throughout the summer protesting for Black lives and against police brutality, being met with police brutality. Exactly. Well, you multiply that by, you know, 73 years and a whole lot more weaponry, and there you go.
Yeah.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
What is the US going to do when it comes to Israel-Palestine? Well, right now they seem to be perfectly happy to sit and watch as the deaths mount and maybe on the side make a little bit of money. So let's talk about those different aspects of this. First of all, Secretary of State Antony Blinken expressed dismay at the escalating violence. He's very dismayed and said the United States was ready to, quote, lend support if the parties seek a ceasefire. Blinken came short of calling for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas or a statement at the United Nations Security Council. That is such an amazing paragraph by the Washington Post there. First of all, he's dismayed. Yes, he's devastated by the situation there. They're not calling for a ceasefire. They're saying if the parties seek a ceasefire, they'll support it. So if Israel decides to stop firing on Gaza, then they'll support that. Well, that's amazing. What's the, are they going to oppose it? That means literally nothing. If the Israeli military decides to stop bombing Gaza, we won't oppose that. That's an amazing statement. And by the way, they're not pushing for a statement at the UN. What are you talking about? We spent all last week blocking statements condemning this action at the UN. That is the effect that the US had internationally in terms of the diplomatic battle that's being faced right now. And by the way, since the Secretary of State is saying, we're just gonna wait and see what the Israeli government decides to do. Well, here is what they've been saying recently. In a televised address, Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel's attacks were continuing at quote full force and would quote take time. Israel wants to levy a heavy price on the Hamas militant group, he said, flanked by his defense minister and political rival, Benny Gantz, in a show of unity, reminding us of the domestic political concerns that are underlying this entire thing. But they want to levy a heavy price on the Hamas militant group. The problem though, is that that price, the currency of it is children and dead civilians, not mainly Hamas militants. Because when you fire on a building that has an office you say is occupied by Hamas, even if we lend you the goodwill to assume that that's correct without the evidence being provided to us, and they've said that it will not be, the entire building goes down. Those people die, the people in the area die or are displaced, and something like 42,000 Palestinians' family have already lost their homes. That's the price that is being levied. Hamas is going to regroup. They're gonna fire more missiles or more rockets in the future. That's what they do. But the civilians, those are the people that are currently paying the price, Francesca.
I mean, honestly, this is where we're seeing some of that status quo, Joe, my brain is not working, but the status quo Joe nickname, there we go. I was like, yes. Nomenclature? What are we talking about?
It kind of fits.
But the status quo Joe, nickname is really fitting right now when it comes to the Middle East, which is sad because this is a guy who wants to get out and is supposedly getting out of Afghanistan. Yes, there's going to be a bunch of troops left over, but for all intents and purposes, we're leaving Afghanistan, right? Obama left Iraq. Like, these were important steps to get the United States out of the Middle East. It seemed like Biden wanted to reshape what the US's role is. And a lot of his language has been about sort of, look, what are we doing there? We're not helping. And yet, when it comes to Israel-Palestine and the idea that the United States does not have a role to play, or that they're gonna wait, or that they pray for a ceasefire, or that they hope, as Biden said, this will run its course, that it'll be over soon, which is just the most callous way to talk about human lives and Israel's decision to continue to bomb and kill them, to run its course, to be done. They'll be over with it. They'll form a government pretty soon and then it'll all be over. No. Imagine if those 2,000 lives that were lost in 2014 were all Israeli. But the last thing I'll say is just that the ball is in the United States court. It is on them to put pressure on Israel, full stop. That is where you start to untangle this entire mess. And Obama, look, man, if Biden wants to continue Obama's legacy, that guy did put a little bit of space. Sure, a lot of it was toothless, but he condemned Israeli settlements. He, you know, said that Netanyahu was a pain in his butt, like all those things.
He didn't do much about it, but yes, he did say
he didn't do much. He annoyed the hell out of Netanyahu, who came to speak at the United States to Congress without even telling the then president. But what I'm saying is, it is a sign that Biden is not serious about changing the United States' role in the Middle East. And to be honest, I think he's actually missing the mark when it comes to where the majority of people are in the United States and our role and what it should be.
I agree. And even where a lot of Democrats are, like there's 30 Senate Democrats calling for a ceasefire. That is not the same thing, by the way, as necessarily wholly embracing a fundamentally new approach to the issue of Israel and Palestine. But they at least are calling for a ceasefire, which the Secretary of State is not. And Biden, Axios has a headline. Some insiders are starting to worry about him doing too much too fast, becoming hyper FDR, basically. What are you talking about? He's talking about running its course. Running its course as if this is like the Israeli military has a case of restless leg syndrome. You just gotta deal with it for a few minutes. No, like they're killing people now. We're the US, we love getting involved in what's going on in other countries. And now we have an opportunity where potentially we can use our great influence, whether in terms of the military, our economy, soft power, all of that, to stop some civilian deaths. Because like, I don't want us to hit 2,200 more civilian lives lost in this most recent conflict. This could be, it's already devastating, but it could be much worse in just a few weeks if we choose not to act And that is what Biden is choosing, even though we have an insane amount of leverage. We provide billions of dollars of military aid basically for free. It's gratis. We don't need anything for it. We won't use that influence for literally anything. We'll just give you the money and then occasionally sell you some weapons and try to make some money. And that is continuing too, with the Biden administration just approving the sale of $735 million in precision guided weapons to Israel. Now, Congress does get to get involved in that. We'll see if the current situation affects that in any way. But right now it's like, it's an amazing situation. He's like, they have a right to self-defense and it's just gonna run its course. And they're starting to run out of some of those JDAMs. Maybe we can sell them some more and make some more money as this runs its course. Part of the course is our contractors making bank off of the murder of civilians.
Yep. No, and I think that's important to remember every time, you know, the Biden administration or anyone says, this is part of our, you know, strategic goals in the region. What are those goals? Can you tell me what those goals are? Are they to displace Palestinian people? Is that the goal? Is the goal, you know, sort of an occupied territory that is no more, that is just absent of the Palestinian people? Is it ethnic cleansing? Is it apartheid? What is your goal, right? Because the US has no goal. What's the goal? Why are you supporting Israel? What are we doing? Are you helping attack Iranian like so-called nuclear facilities to just sort of dust up with that country and like make us look bad? Because Israel's real good at doing that. Like what else are you doing? Are we working with Saudi Arabia to make sure that we do not enact any kind of consequences when they kill and maim and dismember a journalist? Cool, cool, cool. What is our goal? Truly and honestly, what happens if we just leave? What happens if we stop giving money to Israel? My guess is it gets better.
They've got a pretty fully functional domestic weapons production industry. I think that they would be okay at this point.
Great.
But you know, we give money to fossil fuel companies. They're massively profitable. Some money is fine to give out, others not so much. And by the way, as of right now, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe this is a knee-jerk sort of dumb internet guy thing to say, but is there any, what would the difference be if it was still Trump? He would have said really annoying things, definitely. He would have said horrible things about Palestinians. But in terms of what the US government would be doing, what would the difference be? Right now, would there be any difference? We would block the UN from saying anything in the Security Council. We wouldn't pressure the Israeli government to stop, and we'd sell them weapons.
Yeah.
Would there be any difference? Literally, between the guy who's here to return the soul and heart of America to help heal versus Donald Trump? No, I don't think there would be any difference. Someone's suggesting Trump would deport Palestinians. Sure, that might, there might be more hate crimes domestically as a result of insane Islamophobic and, you know, anti-Palestinian things that he would say. That's a good point. It can always be worse, I guess. But in terms of the situation in Gaza, I don't think it'd be that different.
No, you're totally 100% right. The reaction would be 100% the same, and somehow is. And oh my God, what is the Biden administration doing? The only thing I would disagree with, and what I think I would say, is that the moment that's led us here for me has very much been the violence in East Jerusalem, the displacement of Palestinian families, something that was ongoing before Trump was in office, obviously. And the contested, not even contested, but the aggression from Israel in East Jerusalem and to those residents there and those families. But the bombing of Al-Aqsa Mosque, the throwing flashbangs, the tear gas, that all to me says an emboldened Israel, emboldened by the brilliant work of, you know, babyface Kushner and Donald Trump, who had Israeli settlements named after him. Oh my God. So, you know, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, I think definitely was a sign that like the US is like a-okay with, you know, settler colonialism. And the fact that Biden hasn't moved it back, I know people say that doesn't matter. I think it matters. I'm sorry. I think it does matter. And so, yes, you're totally right. Look, this happened in 2014, happened in 2009. The US has been in pretty much lockstep the entire time. But I do think it gets worse. It has gotten worse.
That's true. It has.
And we have an opportunity to potentially make it less worse.
saw a video over the weekend that understandably a lot of people have been very affected by, and it shows a child sort of surveying the devastation of the most recent conflict and talking about it just openly, honestly, about the horror of the situation. I want you to take a look at this.
I'm always sick, I'm always out of milk. I can't do anything. All of this, what do you expect me to do? Fix it? I'm only 10. I can't even do anything in this world. I just want to be a doctor or anything to help my people, but I can't. I'm just a kid. I don't even know what to do. I get scared, but not really that much. I do anything for my people, but I don't know what to do. I'm just 10. I'm just 10. All of this, when I see, I will cheery cry every day, saying to myself, why do we deserve this? Why? What did we do to this? My family said they just hate us. They just don't like us because we are Muslims. Why does Muslims act for you like that? You see all of the kids around me? They're just kids. Why wouldn't you just send a missile to them and kill them? It's not fair.
Yeah, that's just devastating, obviously. I'm just imagining yourself in the position of that kid. And I understand that plenty of Americans might watch that video. First of all, they'll never see it thanks to the media bubbles that we exist in. But if they did see it, they would not be capable of putting themselves in the position of that child or imagining what that life would be like. The immediate horror of worrying that every day that you could be killed, the long-term horror of believing that that's all that your life will ever be, is just fearing for the future and eventually potentially dying.
Yep.
Yeah. But the hope, I guess, at least one silver lining maybe, is that thanks to social media and thanks to media progressing very slightly in this issue, being willing to acknowledge the fundamental humanity of Palestinians, that maybe that video will help to convince people. Maybe critical coverage of the situation there will help move people. And it's too late for Biden. He's got decades of, you know, we'll do anything for Israel, we'll never question them, whatever, locked in. But maybe someday we'll have a president that cares about that girl and what happens to her.
Absolutely. And it's what I think the most devastating part of that video is that it doesn't matter that she's 10, you know? I mean, it's really sweet and she's so honest and it means a lot when it's conveyed by a child, of which there are so many. Like the average age in Gaza is like it's like 17 or 16, something like this. But it doesn't matter that she's 10. It doesn't matter that she's not a doctor. Doctors are being bombed. Doctors are being targeted. If she grew up to be a journalist was killed along with her two children. She was pregnant. You know, I mean, like how many more stories of this do we need? And you know, I do think though, speaking of the media, you know, as someone who used to work for AJ Plus and who has been a big fan of Al Jazeera and their international coverage, Jazeera 10 years ago was the only place that was actually covering a lot of what was going on in Israel, Palestine, in Iraq, in all these other places. And even just in the last 10 years, even since like, let's say 2009 and that war, the Gaza war, or the Israeli bombardment of Gaza in 2009, there's been a change. Like you can find out so much more information about what's actually going on, and outlets, whether it's like Vox or BuzzFeed or, you know, like it's not just TYT and Al Jazeera anymore. Like there are
Did you see John Oliver last night?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Basically, it was a refined, funnier version of what we've been saying for the past week. Yeah.
I got
jokes. And now that can exist.
Funnier
than what I've been saying, as less funny than you, but yes, no. and refined, and you would not have seen that 15 years ago.
Absolutely, and so like it feels like it's the same, and that's why I think we're so mad at Biden, because it's like it's not just we'd expect this. It's look around you. The public opinion is turning. It is changing. Get on board with this. And it's because reality is showing itself that this is completely unjust. So yeah, I'm heartened. I also think that everyone does have a role to play. Look, boycott, divestment, sanctions, which is a movement that sadly a lot of Democrats have decided is somehow bad. It's a nonviolent movement to take money out of Israel and to not do contracts. contracts with, you know, a state that is brutalizing another people, right? That's the idea. So the Presbyterian Church of the United States participated in BDS, divested its holdings from Israel. Like, these are ways, that's what happened in South Africa. These are ways that we can move forward and actually affect change.
Yeah, agreed. There are some in the US government who are saying the right things when it comes to the current situation with Israel and Palestine. One that's been reliable on this topic is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, representative, who said apartheid states aren't democracies. That seems like that would sort of go without saying, but oddly controversial in some quarters, including, by the way, media outlets like MSN, who said AOC calls Israel apartheid state in Twitter outburst over Gaza attacks. By the way, it's the outburst thing, but then can we put their tweet up? It's the photo they chose to use for her. And I understand everybody does this. We sometimes choose our photos to be funny or whatever. But you're saying that her comment about the humanitarian situation in Palestine is an outburst. And you put like her looking at her French bulldog doing a trick right for the first time. Like, that's the photo that you choose to put. I mean, that seems, Francesca, highly misogynistic. Her tweet was, apartheid states aren't democracies. There were no exclamation points. There were no angry emojis. There was nothing that you could cling to label it as an outburst. It was a four-word tweet.
I appreciated your take on this, which is that I don't think that I would ever have a tweet of mine described as an outburst. I wonder why. And it, yes, it's absolutely sexist. I mean, this is what AOC has been dealing with for so long, right? It will continue. But she's not wrong, right? And I think it is important for us to remember that. And I know that people want to sort of deal in the semantics of what is apartheid, what isn't apartheid, but it can't be apartheid because there are two states, right? No, there aren't two states, sadly. There is a fledgling Palestinian Authority that is got all kinds of problems. Hamas was actually democratically elected, but of course, nobody wants to recognize that. I mean, if you look at the West Bank and you look and you see the ways that there are, like, for lack of a better term, Bantustans, right? That's an apartheid term. Small communities surrounded by Israeli military. That looks a lot like apartheid. It looks a lot like ghettoization. And yes, it's not necessarily part of the state of Israel, but that is not an autonomous sovereign state that has control over its own livelihood, not even over its own water resources in many cases. A state that is constantly embattled. So it's almost apartheid plus, right? It is apartheid times 10. Meanwhile, inside of 1948, inside of the state of Israel, it's important to remember, there are Palestinians, there are Muslims who are inside. They have Israeli citizenship, but they don't actually, they're not afforded all of the rights that other Israeli citizens are, that Israeli Jews are afforded. One case in point is they are asked questions and followed if they speak Arabic, that speaking their own language is bad, right? Like it's like low income neighborhoods in the United States or anywhere in the world. Though those Palestinians inside of Israel also don't have full rights, also are not like, you know, living, it's not great for them either. So that's important to remember when we sort of deal with this, like, well, what is apartheid? What isn't apartheid? And all that.
You're 100% right. Great nuance from Francesca. Nuance in short supply in America. And the thing is, we've been talking about how we really do feel like there has been a noted shift between the 2014 violence and now, in how, apparently, looking at polls, how a lot of Americans see this issue. And I credit a lot to social media and the media in general being a little bit more willing to, for instance, highlight Palestinian voices, things like that. But even politicians speaking out, like the 30 Senate Democrats we talked about earlier, AOC's comments, like, she's like, so many of them would have been terrified at the prospect of tweeting something like that before. But now you have people like Rashida Tlaib giving speeches on the House floor. That said, there are those who want to go back to the old ways Meghan McCain tweeted, every single, I don't know why single's capitalized, elected Democrat in Congress, Congress isn't capitalized, but single is in all caps. Anyway, every single elected Democrat in Congress should have to answer if they agree with Ocasio-Cortez that Israel is an apartheid state. Technically, she said apartheid states aren't democracies. Interesting that she fills in the blanks. I understand it's not a big leap at this point, but you're doing the work there, buddy. But anyway, Meghan McCain added, Corbynism has finally made its full and complete formation over here to America, which just grammatically is a gigantic mess. But anyway, so many of us have been ringing the alarm bells for years with the dam finally bursting this week. Choose a metaphor and run with it. You got bells, you got dams, you got a lot going on there, Meghan McCain. But the idea there is she wants punishment for AOC. She wants AOC to be canceled or whatever. I hate that terminology, but she wants some sort of consequences for AOC for being willing to point out something that seems fundamentally true. Meghan McCain doesn't even disagree. It's not that she actually believes that you can maintain this sort of system and have it be a democracy worth a damn. Mm-hmm. She just likes the status quo. She's fine with it. It really doesn't bother her. What Gazans' lives were like before the current violence or the violence happening right now, that is not something that bothers her. What bothers her is the idea that that might change as a result of pressure from politicians like Ocasio-Cortez.
Absolutely. And it, what bothers her is that there is an invisible line for no particular reason of what we can and cannot say when it comes to Israel. Obviously, we know the particular reason is because you'll be charged with anti-Semitism, right? To say nothing, to completely erase all the Jews speaking out right now, all of the people inside of Israel who've done so much work. No, they don't matter. You're anti-Semitic. And so to say apartheid, you're automatically anti-Semitic. To say it's all about the Benjamins, you're automatically anti-Semitic. Like anything that can be skewed as anti-Semitic, it will be. And look, even folks like Nancy Pelosi get, especially folks like Nancy Pelosi get sucked into that BS narrative of criticizing the state of Israel or criticizing the Israeli lobby means you're anti-Semitic. What Meghan McCain needs to answer for is what conservatives think about Israel-Palestine. She needs to answer for the ways that Republicans treat Israel as some sort of nutso revelatory, like this is Armageddon spot when Jesus comes back and all of the Jews are in Israel in the holy place, and then those who don't convert will perish and all of the Christians will ascend to heaven. That crazy theory that absolutely the far right in the United States, the evangelical right believes in, that's what Meghan McCain needs to talk about, okay? Because you've got some people in your corner who are out of their minds, who are anti-Semitic and Islamophobic and do not give a damn about anyone's lives except their own, okay? Let's talk about that. Let's talk about why they actually support Israel. It's because of their like weird biblical prophecy that's not gonna happen, guys. So yeah, sorry.
It's not that they're just suddenly interested in foreign aid and charity abroad. It's very specific. And you're 100% right. Great news from Matt Gaetz. As previewed last week, Joel Greenberg, his party bud, formally pleaded guilty Monday to sex trafficking of a minor and a host of other crimes, agreeing to cooperate fully with prosecutors and testify in court in hopes of leniency for himself. That is a relative leniency because he agreed to plead guilty to 6 different charges: sex trafficking of a child, aggravated identity theft, wire fraud. Some of these come with a mandatory minimum sentence of 12 years and a statutory maximum potentially decades longer. But that said, because of the deal that he's working out, he might not serve that much time. In exchange for pleading guilty, prosecutors agreed to dismiss 27 other counts that he faced and recommend a term within federal sentencing guidelines, which are often far less than the statutory maximum penalties. They also agreed to recommend other possible sentencing breaks. If they determined, for example, that Greenberg provided, quote, substantial assistance in building other cases, they might ask a judge to deviate below the minimum required penalty, according to Greenberg's plea agreement. So what might those other cases look like? Well, prosecutors have been exploring whether Greenberg paid women to have sex with Congressman Matt Gaetz and whether the two shared sexual partners, including the 17-year-old girl at issue in Greenberg's own case. So them wheels are turning, Francesca. I mean, it's still America and Greenberg is still a white conservative like elected official. So he's probably gonna be just fine regardless of what he did, but this is not a good development for the congressman.
Oh, I'm so glad I didn't have breakfast. Just like Greenberg and Gates sharing sexual partners.
That'll bring up the eggs.
My ovaries just dried up like, sorry. Like, do not reproduce. Men are trash. Part of me is like, yes, squeal, tell it all. I mean, he wrote it all down, trying to get a pardon from Trump. Remember that through Roger Stone? Like, oh my God, you're so cute. But yes, please tell us all about Matt Gaetz. But also, like, it just makes you so mad, right? Because we know our criminal justice system. We know who's locked up on like nonviolent drug offenses or on like who loses their lives over counterfeiting a $20 bill, allegedly. Like, and yet over the weekend, we learned that Gaetz and Greenberg also were like coke buddies, right? And they had one of the women was like that they hung out with was an Instagram model / like weed company dealer and who like, you know, would court the young women. Just it's all gross. Like that party, just don't go in, you know, room 325 or whatever. Like it's just one of those. But anyway, so what I'm saying is I hope something sticks. I hope it's not just, if you rat on Matt Gaetz, then that's fine. Like they're drug possession charges here.
Yeah, no, he's going to jail. Like I would hope you don't traffic a child and get away with it unless you're a congressman. He made the very poor life choice of not becoming a Republican congressman. He really should have worked on that. We'll see what information he has. The fact that they vacated 27 counts, I'm not an expert. Maybe we have Adrian Lawrence joining us tomorrow. We'll ask her. It seems to me that you would not do that unless you had received significant cooperation already. Yeah. And apparently he has been providing investigators information about Gaetz specifically since last year, according to a person familiar with the matter. So this would seem to indicate that he provided something more than just, you know, a evidence-free confession letter to Donald Trump. There's got to be more than that. And there almost certainly is, by the way, because one of the threads that has been weaving its way through all of these updates for the past month or so is that Gaetz has done a terrible job of hiding literally any of this. You know, from starting from his face and his whole deal to two people who heard comments directly of him repeatedly boasting to people in Florida politics about women he met through Greenberg, to not hiding his Venmo activity. This guy was as arrogant and overconfident as he was fundamentally mediocre. And those two things, the confluence of those, might be enough to break through the legal protections sort of just implicitly there for white conservative elected officials.
Yeah,
we'll see.
We will see.
Marjorie Greene apparently, beyond just being horrible, also apparently broke the law. So Channel 2 Action News in Atlanta revealed just a few days ago that it had obtained paperwork through public records requests that showed that the new congresswoman and her husband claimed what's called a homestead exemption on two properties, one in Fulton County and one in Floyd County, which is the district that Green now represents. Remembering, of course, that she jumped districts to improve her chance of getting elected, which is something that people say that they don't like, and yet they keep rewarding politicians for doing it. Anyway, what does this actually mean? Well, it's a tax break that lowers the amount of property tax that homeowners must pay on their homes, but it can only be claimed for one house, for fairly obvious reasons, the owner's primary residence. So you're supposed to choose one of those. They decided if one is good, two is twice as nice. So in the county's Floyd County application, Green's husband reportedly left blank a question that asked whether they had an active homestead exemption in another part of the state, which is a note that we're gonna return to. But meanwhile, Fulton County confirmed to the TV network that the pair's tax break on their home in that county was still active. So they had simultaneous homestead exemptions in two different counties, explicitly what you're not supposed to do. And it is one thing, and look, spoiler alert, they're gonna claim that it was just an oversight or whatever, or that the county's made a mistake. But when you are directly asked, hey now, you don't already have one of these, do you? And you're like, I didn't see that, or this doesn't look like anything to me. That seems a bit more suspicious when you accidentally don't confirm or deny whether you're breaking the law. Francesca, what are your thoughts?
Look, as someone who's terrible at test taking, I have left a lot of boxes blank. So, like, I feel like I identify with that a little bit, but I don't have two homes. I don't have one home. So, there you go. Marjorie Greene, in the end of the day, is exactly what so many MAGA folks are, which are not the working poor. They're not blue collar. They are people who inherited a boatload of money from their dads or a boat itself, and then are claiming that they're the forgotten class, that they, and that class really means white people. We know that she's done this, right? Like, this is just, again, it is par for the course. It makes sense. I would be disappointed if she had been honest on her taxes. It's on brand, and
and the brand will continue. By the way,
it keeps going.
So, like, over on Twitch, let's see, trying to find the comment. Okay, very smooth, John. Oh yeah, Ryu Ral says this is clearly the left trying to cancel Green. I bet this will be her reply to this. Well, sort of, and that's just all that. Like Gates, all of these updates have come out, just devastating stuff from his best bud, like a guy he trusts to share sexual partners and lines of coke with. And his response is, They're just trying to cancel me. They're really coming for you, but I'm in the way. Like, come on, conservatives. Do you not get bored with that? Like, if we found out that, like, AOC had run a guy down and buried him in the forest, and she's like, this is cancel culture run amok, I would want a little bit more than that, I think. I'd want to know why she bought that shovel and that quick lime. I would want details, but they don't. They really don't. And so here is how you can respond. If you're a conservative, Green responded to the allegations by telling the Channel 2 Action News that the reporter on the story, quote, needs to mind his own business instead of launching yet another pathetic attempt to smear me and my family. Mind your own business?
Yep, CNN, just mind your own business. I never kiss and tell. What does that even mean? You know.
That's not good enough. You were being alleged to have broken the law and you say, mind your beeswax. That's not good enough.
My daddy always told me to just, you know, if you don't have tea to spill, you just keep stirring it.
That might be I don't even know, that might be real. Anyway, 15 hours after the story aired, they'd had a little bit of time to do what passes for thinking. A spokesperson for Marjorie Greene issued a second statement calling it fake news, obviously, and blaming Fulton County for the error, writing, quote, Fulton County did not respond to a request to cancel the exemption in January, possibly due to COVID. Everything has now been corrected. Okay, so that is a specific verifiable claim. If you sent them requests to fix this error, bring the receipts. And if you did, fine. Okay, then we'll move on. Maybe Channel 2 Action News got it wrong. It still begs the question of why you weirdly left off the acknowledgement of whether you were breaking the law with the homestead exemption and all of that. But maybe it's possible. But until you provide that information, I'm just gonna be one of those Americans that sees another rich person trying to violate tax laws to get ever more wealthy and think, that's not the most surprising thing in the world. And Republican politicians break a lot of laws these days. So I think the onus is gonna be a little bit on you, especially because we're not at the point of actual charges. This is not a, you know, like innocent until proven guilty thing. This is the media has done an investigation. You can respond however you want. And thus far, your response is kind of blow. That's all I'm saying. Any other thoughts?
No, you said
okay.
It.
It's a B-roll. Woo. We get to use this B-roll because the spacemen are coming, apparently. I want to show you a video that we saw over the weekend from the former head of the UFO investigation program, now known as the UAP program, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. Anyway, here is what this former head had to say.
Buried away in the Pentagon, ATIP was part of a $22 million program sponsored by then Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid to investigate UFOs. When Elizondo took over in 2010, he focused on the national security implications of unidentified aerial phenomena documented by U.S. service members.
Imagine a technology that can do 600 to 700 G-forces, that can fly at 13,000 miles an hour, that it can evade radar, and that can fly through air and water and possibly space. And oh, by the way, has no obvious signs of propulsion, no wings, no control surfaces, and yet still can defy the natural effects of Earth's gravity. That's precisely what we're seeing.
Elizondo tells us ATIP was a loose-knit mix of scientists, electro-optical engineers, avionics, and intelligence experts, often working part-time. They combed through data and records and analyzed videos like this. A Navy air crew struggles to lock onto a fast-moving object off the U.S. Atlantic coast in 2015.
Okay, so Francesca, look, you requested this story, and I have to say, it is amazing that this stuff is out there. I don't mean that the craft are out there.
You mean the truth? Is the truth out there?
Is out. Well, I just want to believe, but that, like, the Pentagon has a group looking into this. They have this crazy video. Look, there are crazy people in the government. We know that. So just because the former head of this group is saying it doesn't mean this guy's not crazy. I don't know him. We don't hang out. But it's barely news that the Pentagon is seriously looking into and has some evidence of these UAPs, which I understand you would not pronounce this way, but I am really struggling to not call those WAPs.
Yeah, it's WAP.
Or WAPs. WAP. But anyway, yeah.
That's why anyway, they come to Earth this year. They were like, oh, that's us. WAP, WAP, WAP.
And it can travel fast through water, so that's not a problem for it. Okay, now that said, Francesca, you requested this story. Tell me what you think about it.
Okay, first of all, Mulder, wow. Mulder really kind of like let himself go, grew the soul patch.
Come on.
You know, I'm not, okay, fine. But no, there literally is like an X-Files entity within the Pentagon, $22 million, and they tried to shut it down. And then according to 60 Minutes, both this guy Elizondo and his partner, his Scully, obviously, continued to work on this. They fell in love. There was like a hot moment in the movie. Anyway, no. But I don't think they fell in love, but I would. But the point is, they continued to work on it even though the budget was cut from what they were doing. And we've all seen those videos where it's like bro-y pilots are like, whoa, dude, check it out. Which I think is
all
just
of
really
them played
funny.
In my mind by Keanu Reeves. But yes.
It is interesting. Obviously, there are people. My problem with this story is anyone who thinks they know that those are definitively WAPs. Or definitively not WAPs, like that they are definitively UFOs or not. Cause there are a lot of people who are like, nuh-uh, cause an astrophysicist would know that, like, you think they don't know that? You think they're not? You think these guys just got their job off LinkedIn? You know, it's not the Trump administration.
Yeah. Look, I obviously, like I joked, but I do wanna believe. I'm a nerd. I grew up on Star Trek and Star Wars and Battlestar Galactica and all that stuff. I wanna believe, but I will say, while the evidence is interesting, and you know what, hold on, I'm gonna save my conclusion. We have a little bit more of this, and I'm fascinated now. So let's go to more from 60 Minutes.
Anything that enters an airspace that's not supposed to be there is a threat.
After receiving classified briefings on UAPs, Senator Marco Rubio called for a detailed analysis. This past December, while he was still head of the Intelligence Committee, he asked the Director of National Intelligence and the Pentagon to present Congress an unclassified report by next month.
This is a bizarre issue. The Pentagon and other branches of the military have a long history of sort of dismissing this. What makes you think that this time is going to be different?
I mean, we're going to find out when we get that report. You know, there's a stigma on Capitol Hill. I mean, some of my colleagues are very interested in this topic and some kind of, you know, giggle when you bring it up. But I don't think we can allow the stigma to keep us from having an answer to a very fundamental question.
Okay. Look, it being Marco Rubio that's working on it does not necessarily give me more faith necessarily. He is a joke in a lot of different ways, but yes, there are people who take this seriously. I will say though, Francesca, I find that in recent years, even though this should have no effect whatsoever on an evaluation of whether intelligent life exists somewhere else in the universe or its ability to travel to us, I find it harder to believe that aliens exist and have visited us because of what we've experienced over the past few years. Like, I don't know why, but it feels for some reason that like Trump being president and aliens existing doesn't seem right together. Or maybe more importantly, I kind of don't want aliens to exist as much, because after the experience of the pandemic, are you telling me you have faith in how humanity would respond to the revelation that aliens exist and they're among us? Do you want any part
of that?
It'll
be just like Independence Day. We'll all join together and then someone will punch an alien and be like, welcome to Earth, bitch. Like, that's exactly.
That part would definitely happen, but it would be a hate crime and it'd be on the streets of Brooklyn. Some alien would just be walking.
Yeah, and then we'd be talking about all the wokies who just hate, you know, the idea of punch. Is it ever okay to punch an alien? I wonder. Let's talk about it.
I just. Oh God, can you imagine how Fox and Friends would talk about them? Oh, it'd be devastating. We'd finally get an alien congressperson and they would just, they'd have all these ads where like, they have like a UFO on a target and they're shooting it or whatever. It would just, it'd be too much. I used to want aliens, but I just hope that they give us a wide berth for the next 20 or 30
years. We're not ready for them. No, I'm definitely, look, if they're real, I'm definitely like going to the highest mountaintop with a sign and being like, take me.
Like, you're gonna be like the woman from Independence Day on the rooftop.
I am so that woman. I like anyone else wanna join me? Hell yeah, cause it's gotta be better than this. It's gotta be better. But I think the real thing is it Elon Musk's pet project? I don't know, guys, I don't think so. You love Space Force or SpaceX, but how many of those rockets have just fell into the ocean, okay? It's not that amazing, Teslas are exploding, okay? I don't think Elon's got this one. Is it China? I don't know, I don't think so either. I don't know if there's any other country or any other private entity that can do this. Like that amount of speed and like going in the water, and I don't know, guys, are X-Men real?
I don't think so.
Is John an X-Jet?
No, I'm not. I wouldn't be able to. I'd be too excited. I wouldn't be able to keep it secret. I don't know. I don't think that it's within our capabilities. That said, it could be something else. I'm too dumb to continue this sentence, but smart enough to know not to. Anyway, I will say I hope that in the next few weeks, John Oliver delves into this, because I want him to find more stuff like the Marco Rubio, old stuff of like politicians revealing too much. That's what I want. Cause I do wanna believe. I wanna believe, and more importantly, I wanna have faith that aliens being revealed could be anything other than just another massive disaster and disappointment, fundamental disappointment and depression for the species that we are.
No, they're definitely, it's like they're like parents in kindergarten where they're slow driving by and they're like, they're not ready. You know, like I'll just let them. They're not playing well enough yet, you know. Let them work it out. Then mom will come to the rescue. That kind of thing, you know. I don't know if that's how parenting works, but the point is we're not ready for aliens. We've got way too much to figure out. But or it could unite us.
No, that was the most unrealistic thing about Independence Day. Anyway, thank you, Francesca, as always, for making this day and the start of the week a little bit more fantastic. I want you to rest up. Between now and next week, I know you're not going to, you got a ton of work to do, but you're gonna be taking the reins on the damage report. And so I'm very excited for that.
Yeah, me too. And everybody listen to the Bituation Room podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, and follow me at Franny Fio on YouTube and everywhere else.
And by the way, everybody, we do have a top 10 list coming. It is gonna be one of the solo ones, a much requested top 10 movies in the MCU. It's about to get nerdy in a particular way that Francesca would just mock me too much. So I'm gonna do it myself. I'm gonna give you my top 10. That will be available later on today for our tier 2 and tier 3 members on YouTube. So if you're already one of those, it's coming. If you'd like to get access to it, you got time, and you'll get access to the entire library of past top 10 lists. We've got like 30 of them at this point, and we have a lot of fun with them. That said, until next time, stay safe out there, stay sane out there. We'll see you soon. Okay, everyone, welcome back to another top 10 list. Thank you, first of all, for being tier 2 or tier 3 members on YouTube and making this available. We do have something special for you. So almost always these top 10 lists are myself and Francesca Fiorentini. Occasionally, when the topic merits, I'll do it solo. And that is the case this week. I'm doing a request I've seen a couple of different times, which is for me to rank the top 10 Marvel movies. It was pretty much the instant I had posted the top 10 Star Wars movies, people were like, well, we want to hear your terrible take on the MCU. So I have combed through the 23 current films, and this is my ranking. I also had to resist the urge to put Black Widow on the list.
No, I haven't seen it yet, but I know that it's going to be great. It's got David Harbour. It's got Florence Pugh. I think it's going to be really good. But I'm only going with the ones that have currently been made available. This is, I think it's a good timing for it because we're about to launch into the next big wave of movies. And over the course of this year, we've got Black Widow. We've got Shang-Chi is coming out. We've got The Eternals. Doctor Strange is less than a year away. Like, the number of movies is going to double in the next couple of years. But this is, like, up until basically around Endgame, that first big thing. So, feel free to at me. Feel free to post below. I know you're going to hate my list, but this is what I've got. At number 10, we have got Spider-Man Homecoming. Now, I did not have very high hopes for Spider-Man, the relaunch of Spider-Man, mostly because I really like the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man, and I'm not that huge of a fan of the character. I never watched the ones with Andrew Garfield, I'm going to say. And so I actually took like a year and a half to watch Spider-Man Homecoming. I didn't see it in theaters. I didn't watch it immediately once it was made available. But I think they did a really good job of relaunching the character. I think that the actor they got, quite good. He gets the sort of quippy, funny part of Spider-Man. He doesn't seem like a sort of stoic, battle-hardened warrior like, you know, a lot of the other characters. I thought that the suite of side characters they put in there were good. And the Vulture was great. Incredibly tense scenes. That scene where they're driving together, I think to the dance, I think it is. One of the tensest scenes in the MCU. And the other one was okay, Far From Home. I thought it was fine. But Homecoming, just a very clean movie, a great version of that origin story for Spider-Man. We'll see how the next one goes. And Spider-Man generally, by the way, has been a great addition to the MCU. At number 9, I have the big original, Marvel's The Avengers, which, you know, it's not super highly ranked. I think it's really good. You know, the bringing together the team, it was really the proof of concept for the MCU that this thing can actually work. We can do all of our solo things, and then you know what? We can bring them all together and make something good. That said, for me, Loki's not the best villain. I don't know. The ending, I liked them teaming up together at the end. Iron Man, you know, making that sacrifice is a great, you know, sort of, I guess, foreshadowing of what's going to end up happening with him in Endgame. But it's a lot of punching, you know, the Chitauri or whatever. So it was fine. It was fine. It was a good movie. I liked the stuff on the little, you know, floating base and all that. Coming at number 8, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, not as good of a film as the first one. I think most people would agree on that. That said, it does have certain advantages over most of the rest of the MCU. The Marvel sense of humor, the quippy Joss Whedon sort of thing that they do, is probably at its best in Guardians of the Galaxy. And that it might not have been quite as good in the second one as the first, but still very good. Great moments with Drax, you know, his belief that he's, you know, can just turn invisible. Baby Groot, quite good. I like the expanding of the team with Mantis. I thought that the larger role for Yondu was quite good. The villain, I didn't find Ego. I didn't find nearly as interesting as the stuff with Ronan, even though, you know, Ronan's not the best character or whatever. But I didn't love the stuff with the father. But, you know, we find out that, you know, Yondu is Mary Poppins, y'all. It's got some great moments. Very funny. Almost as good of a soundtrack as the first one. So not bad at number 8. Number 7 is Thor Ragnarok. And Thor Ragnarok makes the list. It almost should be higher up on the list. They apparently decided, okay, we've done Thor 1. Fine. We've done Thor 2. Maybe the worst movie in the MCU. We need something new. And that something new was bringing in other characters. You know, at this point in the MCU, none of these movies are truly solo anymore, and that helps. But more importantly, can we get a sense of humor? Honestly, can we not have Thor be this sort of boring stick in the mud? And they did that, and wow, they did a great job in Thor Ragnarok. Taika Waititi is obviously awesome. I thought that the sort of buddy comedy between him and the Hulk was great. Hela was an awesome villain. Very good. He brings in some side characters that he meets, you know, on the Gladiator planet that are great additions to the story as well. And oh, what's the name of the guy? Jeff Goldblum is awesome in whatever he does. And this is a great role for him as well. So it was an exciting movie, great soundtrack, good humor, Thor Ragnarok. And especially because I did not like that second one at all. Now, Thor Love and Thunder, I have very high expectations for. It's one of my most anticipated MCU movies because of how good Ragnarok was. That said, there are six movies I deemed better, although I'm wondering now. Number six is Black Panther. Black Panther was 95% awesome. Great. It's not really an origin story for the hero, but it's the first that we're really seeing him. You get a little bit of him in Civil War. So getting to see not just Black Panther, but actually seeing a bunch of Wakanda, of his extended family, the culture of Wakanda, how they choose the Black Panther, the spirituality of it. It was just great world building. It was more world building than we generally get. Like as a counterexample, Doctor Strange, I feel like building out that world, not as compelling. And, you know, maybe there are other examples of that. Thor: The Dark World. No, not nearly as compelling of setting up a sort of new world within a world. They did a great job with Black Panther in that. Some pretty good fights, some good side characters. I thought that having Bilbo there, quite good. That said, while the conflict at the heart of Black Panther is very interesting, and I like it, the political, you know, like ramifications and all that, I didn't love the villains so much. And more so than that, the final fight was DC quality. It was two CGI characters punching each other a whole bunch. And that is when these movies are at their worst. I loved Wonder Woman. The last fight at the end of Wonder Woman was terrible because it's two CGI creations punching each other. And so that, unfortunately, was sort of part of the end of Black Panther. But overall, a great movie. Obviously, very excited for the second one. Obviously, the context is the tragedy of the loss. But yeah, number five is going to be Captain America: Civil War. So this is not technically an Avengers movie. It is a Captain America movie, but it is effectively an Avengers movie. And it was great. I mean, like, really cranking up the conflict and making all of these different characters choose which side they're going to support, having the philosophy battled about as they're actually battling each other. Was it handled perfectly well? Perhaps not. There's been great criticism of how the sort of iconic scene of Captain America: Civil War is the airport fight. Like, they're joking as they're fighting each other, which makes for great cinema, but doesn't really make sense that these longtime friends and allies would be joking as they're potentially killing each other. Okay, but set that aside, the fights are some of the best. It might be one of the best big group battles, you know, before we get to Endgame. You get a little bit more Iron Man, you get the introduction of Spider-Man, you get the introduction of Black Panther. I think the Winter Soldier becomes a much more interesting character there. This movie did a lot of work in setting up the stuff that will happen later. I need to rewatch it again. I think I've honestly only seen it once, but it really did stand out. They did a great job. Now, number four, we get into very hard decisions here. I mean, they've all been hard, but it is very hard to choose favorites. It reminds me a lot of the Star Wars list. Number four, I'm putting Iron Man. Oh, that feels like it should be higher up. So Iron Man was the first. I mean, technically Incredible Hulk, but we're really not counting that. Iron Man was, here is a modern superhero movie. That's not Batman or whatever. And was very different than even those. Like, Batman, those movies were very successful, but this is a very different sort of thing. It's a character that not a lot of people had a great deal of familiarity with if you weren't a fan of the comics, which I really wasn't. There are certain comics I read, but I didn't read Avengers growing up. And they brought in, he was a very compelling actor, taking the role seriously. It wasn't overly campy unnecessarily. It was funny, but had great action. It's an amazing origin story. The first 25 minutes or so of Iron Man is among the better 25 minutes of all the MCU movies. Like, what a great origin story. And the fact that immediately right off the bat in the MCU, they're talking about the military, they're talking about war, what our obligations are, what is humane and all of that. And so quite good. And it's this good of a movie, even though the villain isn't that great. he's okay. The Ironmonger, I think it is. It was fine. It was fine. And better than Iron Man 2 or 3. It proved that this format could work. And so thank you to Iron Man. Quite a good movie. I watched it again recently and it really does hold up. At number 3, we have Avengers Infinity War. So, I mean, how do you, like these last three, how do you really choose? Infinity War, it is a massive confluence of characters, even beyond what we'd seen in past Avengers movies. Like, one of the biggest cliffhangers in movies, you know, like the loss of so much, they come so close. There's this amazing, huge battle at the end of it. You have the different missions that are going on simultaneously. As I'm talking about, I'm feeling like I gotta watch this movie again. It was just great. There were so many really tense, close moments. Yeah, Avengers Infinity War was quite good. I saw it several times in theaters. Obviously, you know, people went crazy for it, understandably so. I think it's, well, I can't say anything without spoiling the top two, but quite good. I need to watch that again soon. Number 2, I have Guardians of the Galaxy. Am I crazy that I ranked this so high? I've always loved Guardians of the Galaxy. I've watched it maybe the most of these movies. It's either that or maybe Endgame at this point that I've watched the most. But Guardians of the Galaxy really nailed the humor, as I talked about with the second volume. But it's like kind of a cleaner movie. Like, having this group of really interesting characters who you watch the trailer and you just assume, oh, it's this team that's going to fight crime or whatever, like around the galaxy. But no, like there's a lot of conflict, huge personalities clashing with each other, beset on all sides by different sets of enemies. And yet they're like sort of learning to come together. And throughout it, as I said, great sense of humor, the best soundtrack of any of these movies. Some of the most interesting characters. Like, I'm a huge Rocket Raccoon fan. It's got some iconic fights. Yondu is absolutely awesome at it. The villain Ronan is okay, honestly. Some of the sub-villains are maybe more compelling, like Nebula. But the final assault with, was it on Nova Prime? Where Ronan's ship is coming in and they lock the big net against them. Awesome. The dance-off is great. It's got a great conclusion. It really made the Infinity Stones far more interesting, and it broadened the scope of the movies. That, I mean, I guess Thor did that a little bit too, but now you're really seeing that this is beyond just Earth. Love Guardians of the Galaxy. I think it's held up very well to rewatching. But that does leave one more film, which everybody at this point already knows what it is. In fact, I already said its name. Number 1 is Avengers Endgame. And I worry that this might be sort of a cheat, because what makes Endgame so good is not necessarily the content of Endgame, or at least the majority of the content of Endgame. Although, I think that they did interesting things with the characters. I think that, Hawkeye aside, look, Tony Stark, very interesting turn for him. How each person has processed those years really lets you see each of these characters through a new lens. I mean, like, what happened to Thor? Obviously, pretty fascinating. He's been through a lot. Hulk as well. Like, there's been a lot of growth in these characters. Damn, Infinity War was good, though. But anyway, like, it moves fast. You don't expect the killing of Thanos so early. The mission is really interesting. The fact that it involves time travel, for the most part, I'm generally against in films like this, but they did interesting things with it. Having, you know, Captain America fight himself, being able to re-see some of those iconic scenes involving Loki or Captain America in the elevator, that was pretty cool. You know, making Ant-Man a significant part of this. I wish that I'd been able to fit one of the Ant-Mans on the list, but it unfortunately didn't fit. And then, of course, you have the bulk of it. Great showdowns between the sort of core characters and Thanos. Everybody rightfully loses it when Captain America finally lifts Mjolnir. That's all great. And then the moment of moments, the one that made this the number one, the most iconic moment in any movie, I think, sue me, I know I'm a nerd or whatever. And the moment that, God, I'm so glad that I saw this in theaters and I can't wait to someday see it in theaters again. I saw it two or three times, I think, is the portal scene. It is like, if movies are about setting up this series of like conflicts and obstacles, trying and failing, and then eventually having sort of this deep, dark moment before triumph, this, they had set it up for 22 movies at that point. And you really do feel like we're going to lose everything again. It is so dark, the depths that they go to, and then they come back in. And I love, by the way, now that it's Anthony Mackie, that's the sort of first moment of it. And then you have Black Panther. I really liked Captain Falcon Falcon and the Winter Soldier. But that portal scene is just amazing. Great moments in the huge fight. I mean, look, it's a big mess. Obviously, not every moment can be perfect, but they made room for things like, long before I was a huge fan of Wanda, thanks to WandaVision, she has that great moment with Thanos. That started to make me think, oh, maybe this is a pretty interesting character, actually. The return of Captain Marvel is done amazingly. Doctor Strange gets a good couple moments in. Spider-Man. Yes, the girls get it done moment is a little bit hitting you over the head, but I loved it. I thought that it was pretty great. And they really do a good job of giving everyone, basically everyone, a couple of good moments during this showdown of showdowns. And then the resolution of the storylines of both Tony Stark and Captain America. Amazing character arcs over so many movies. And I think both of them were done very well. Yeah, I mean, it was a great movie. Like you can watch the audience reactions and all that. And it's, I don't know, it still hits me the same. And there's never been anything like it. There's never been anything like Endgame, because there's never been anything like the MCU to lead to. There's been series with a lot of movies. There's a billion James Bond movies, but it isn't the same thing. You can't have that same sort of moment. This was a very carefully constructed and almost universally, expertly constructed and conceived of arc of movies. And you either like it or you don't, I guess. There's some people that don't. All I know is it was an amazing ride. I'm looking forward to a rewatch of basically all the movies. There's just a couple that I'm not a huge fan of. Very excited for what comes next. Like, I cannot wait to be in the theaters watching Black Widow and seeing what the hell the Eternals is about. I do a lot of research on these movies afterward to get more context. I don't generally do it beforehand. I went into the Guardians of the Galaxy knowing nothing about the Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm gonna do the same for the Eternals. But Shang-Chi, great trailer. Can't wait to see what that's about. The series so far, WandaVision was amazing. Falcon the Winter Soldier was great. So I have great hopes from that. I just think that they ended it right, and they're launching into another phase that, like, could it be even better? I don't know. We'll see. But anyway, maybe in about a year, we'll have had about four new movies. I'll see if maybe the list has changed with the rewatch and everything. But feel free to let me know what you think the correct order is down below. And as always, I'm always down to see your suggestions for top 10 lists. I would love to credit you if you provide a good one. So feel free to do that. And thank you, as always, for being tier 2 or tier 3 members, providing a little bit of financial support and making this extra content possible. Love doing it for you, and look forward to seeing what comes in future Mondays. Until then, see you next time. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.